knew his father. I knew who his grandfather was in Kabul and his great-grandfather before him. I could sit here and trace generations of his ancestors for you if you asked. That's why when his father, God give him peace, came Khostegori, I didn't hesitate. And believe me, his father wouldn't have agreed to ask for your hand if he didn't know whose descendant you were. Blood is a powerful thing, Bachim. And when you adopt, you don't know whose blood you're bringing into your house. Now, if you were American, it wouldn't matter. People here marry for love. Family name and ancestry never even come into the equation. They adopt that way too. As long as the baby's healthy, everyone's happy. But we are Afghans, Bachim. Is the fish almost ready? Surayya said. General Tahiri's eyes lingered on her. He patted her knee. Just be happy you have your health and a good husband, he said. What do you think, Amir John? Khala Jamila said. I put my glass on the ledge, where a row of her potted geraniums were dripping water. I think I agree with General Sahib, I said. Reassured, the general nodded and went back to the grill. We all had our reasons for not adopting. Surayya had hers, the general his, and I had this. That perhaps something, someone, somewhere, had decided to deny me fatherhood for the things I had done. Maybe this was my punishment, and perhaps justly so. It wasn't meant to be, Khala Jamila had said. Or, maybe, it was meant not to be. A few months later, we used the advance for my second novel and placed a down payment on a pretty two-bedroom Victorian house in San Francisco's Bernal Heights. It had a peaked roof, hardwood floors, and a tiny backyard which ended in a sun deck and a fire pit. The general helped me refinish the deck and paint the walls. Khala Jamila bemoaned us moving almost an hour away, especially since she thought Surayya needed all the love and support she could get, oblivious to the fact that her well-intended but overbearing sympathy was precisely what was driving Surayya to move. Sometimes, Surayya sleeping next to me, I lay in bed and listened to the screen door swinging open and shut with the breeze and to the crickets chirping in the yard. And I could almost feel the emptiness in Surayya's womb, like it was a living, breathing thing. It had seeped into our marriage, that emptiness, into our laughs and our lovemaking. And late at night, in the darkness of our room, I would feel it rising from Surayya and settling between us, sleeping between us, like a newborn child. June 2001. I lowered the phone into the cradle and stared at it for a long time. It wasn't until Aflatun startled me with a bark that I realized how quiet the room had become. Surayya had muted the television. You look pale, Amir, she said from the couch, the same one her parents had given us as a housewarming gift for our first apartment. She had been lying on it with Aflatun's head nestled on her chest, her legs buried under the worn pillows. She was half watching a PBS special on the plight of wolves in Minnesota, half correcting essays from her summer school class. She had been teaching at the same school now for 6 years. She sat up, and Aflatun leapt down from the couch. It was the general who had given our Cocker Spaniel his name, which was Farsi for Plato, because, he said, if you looked hard enough and long enough into the dog's filmy black eyes, you'd swear he was thinking wise thoughts. There was a sliver of fat, just a hint of it, beneath Surayya's chin now. The past 10 years had padded the curves of her hips some and combed into her coal-black hair a few streaks of cinder gray. But she still had the face of a grand ball princess, with her bird-in-flight eyebrows and nose elegantly curved like a letter from ancient Arabic writings. You look pale, Surayya repeated, placing the stack of papers on the table. I have to go to Pakistan, I said. She stood up. Pakistan? "Rahim Khan is very sick," I said. A fist clenched inside me with those words. Kaka's old business partner? She had never met Rahim Khan, but I had told her about him. I nodded. "Oh," she said. "I'm so sorry, Amir." "We used to be close," I said. "When I was a kid, he was the first grown-up I ever thought of as a friend. I pictured him and Baba drinking tea in Baba's study, then smoking near the window, a sweet briar-scented breeze blowing from the garden and bending the twin columns of smoke." "I remember you telling me that," Suraya said. She paused. "How long will you be gone?" "I don't know. He wants to see me," I said. "Is it?" she began. "Yes, it is safe. I'll be all right, Suraya." It was the question she'd wanted to ask all along. 15 years of marriage had turned us into mind readers. "I'm going for a walk," I said. "Should I go with you?" "Nay, I'd rather be alone." I drove to Golden Gate Park and walked along Spreckles Lake on the northern edge of the park. It was a beautiful Sunday afternoon. The sun sparkled on the water where dozens of miniature boats sailed, propelled by a crisp San Francisco breeze. I sat on a park bench and watched a man toss a football to his son, telling him not to sidearm the ball, to throw over the shoulder. I glanced up and saw a pair of kites, red with long blue tails. They floated high above the trees on the west end of the park and over the windmills. I thought about a comment Rahim Khan had made just before we hung up. He made it in passing, almost as an afterthought. I closed my eyes and saw him at the other end of the scratchy long-distance line, and saw him with his lips slightly parted, head tilted to one side. And again, something in his bottomless black eyes hinted at an unspoken secret between us. Except now, I knew he knew. My suspicions had been right all those years. He knew about Osef, the kite, the money, the watch with the lightning bolt hands. He had always known. "Come, there's a way to be good again," Rahim Khan had said on the phone just before hanging up. He had said it in passing, almost as an afterthought. A way to be good again. When I came home, Suraya was on the phone with her mother. "Won't be long, Madarjan. A week, maybe two. Yes, you and Padar can come stay with me." 2 years earlier, the general had broken his right hip. He had had one of his migraines again, and emerging from his room, bleary-eyed and dazed, he had tripped on a loose carpet edge. His scream had brought Khala Jamila running from the kitchen. "It sounded like a joru, a broomstick, snapping in half," she was always fond of saying, though the doctor had said it was unlikely she'd heard anything of the sort. The general's shattered hip and all of the ensuing complications, the pneumonia, blood poisoning, the protracted stay at the nursing home, ended Khala Jamila's long-running soliloquies about her own health and started new ones about the general's. She would tell anyone who'd listen that the doctors had told him his kidneys were failing. "But then, they had never seen Afghan kidneys, had they?" she'd say proudly. What I remember most about the general's hospital stay is how Khala Jamila would wait until he fell asleep and then sing to him, songs I remembered from Kabul, playing on Baba's scratchy old transistor radio. The general's frailty and time had softened things between him and Suraya, too. They took walks together and went to lunch on Saturdays, and sometimes the general sat in on some of her classes. He would sit in the back of the room, dressed in his shiny old gray suit, wooden cane across his lap, smiling. Sometimes he even took notes. That night, Suraya and I lay in bed, her back pressed to my chest, my face buried in her hair. I remembered when we used to lay forehead to forehead, sharing afterglow kisses and whispering until our eyes drifted closed, whispering about tiny curled toes, first smiles, first words, first steps. We still did sometimes, but the whispers were about school, my new book, a giggle over someone's ridiculous dress at a party. Our lovemaking was still good, at times better than good. But some nights, all I would feel was a relief to be done with it, to be free to drift away and forget, at least for a while, about the futility of what we had just done. She never said so, but I knew sometimes Soraya felt it too. On those nights, we would each roll to our side of the bed and let our own savior take us away. Soraya's was sleep. Mine, as always, was a book. I lay in the dark the night Rahim Khan called and traced with my eyes the parallel silver lines on the wall made by moonlight pouring through the blinds. At some point, maybe just before dawn, I drifted to sleep and dreamed of Hassan running in the snow, the hem of his green chapan dragging behind him, snow crunching under his black rubber boots. He was yelling over his shoulder, "For you, 1,000 times over." A week later, I sat on a window seat aboard a Pakistani International Airlines flight, watching a pair of uniformed airline workers remove the wheel chocks. The plane taxied out of the terminal and soon we were airborne, cutting through the clouds. I rested my head against the window, waited in vain for sleep. 3 hours after my flight landed in Peshawar, I was sitting on shredded upholstery in the back seat of a smoke-filled taxicab. My driver, a chain-smoking, sweaty little man who introduced himself as Ghulam, drove nonchalantly and recklessly, averting collisions by the thinnest of margins, all without so much as a pause in the incessant stream of words spewing from his mouth. "Terrible what is happening in your country, Yar. Afghani people and Pakistani people, they are like brothers, I tell you. Muslims have to help Muslims, so..." I tune him out, switch to a polite nodding mode. I remembered Peshawar pretty well from the few months Baba and I had spent there in 1981. We were heading west now on Jamrud Road, past the cantonment and its lavish, high-walled homes. The bustle of the city blurring past me reminded me of a busier, more crowded version of the Kabul I knew, particularly of the Koche Murgha, or chicken bazaar, where Hassan and I used to buy chutney-dipped potatoes and cherry water. The streets were clogged with bicycle riders, milling pedestrians, and rickshaws popping blue smoke, all weaving through a maze of narrow lanes and alleys. Bearded vendors draped in thin blankets sold animal skin lampshades, carpets, embroidered shawls, and copper goods from rows of small, tightly jammed stalls. The city was bursting with sounds. The shouts of vendors rang in my ears, mingled with the blare of Hindi music, the sputtering of rickshaws, and the jingling bells of horse-drawn carts. Rich scents, both pleasant and not so pleasant, drifted to me through the passenger window. The spicy aroma of pakora and the nihari Baba had loved so much, blended with the sting of diesel fumes, the stench of rot, garbage, and feces. A little past the red brick buildings of Peshawar University, we entered an area my garrulous driver referred to as Afghan Town. I saw sweet shops and carpet vendors, kebab stalls, kids with dirt-caked hands selling cigarettes, tiny restaurants, maps of Afghanistan painted on their windows, all interlaced with backstreet aid agencies. "Many of your brothers in this area, Yar. They are opening businesses, but most of them are very poor." He tisked his tongue and sighed. "Anyway, we're getting close now." I thought about the last time I had seen Rahim Khan, in 1981. He had come to say goodbye the night Baba and I had fled Kabul. I remember Baba and him embracing in the foyer, crying softly. When Baba and I arrived in the U.S., he and Rahim Khan kept in touch. They would speak 4 or 5 times a year, and sometimes Baba would pass me the receiver. The last time I had spoken to Rahim Khan had been shortly after Baba's death. The news had reached Kabul, and he had called. We had only spoken for a few minutes and lost the connection. The driver pulled up to a narrow building at a busy corner where two winding streets intersected. I paid the driver, took my loan suitcase, and walked up to the intricately carved door. The building had wooden balconies with open shutters. From many of them, laundry was hanging to dry in the sun. I walked up the creaky stairs to the second floor, down a dim hallway to the last door on the right. I checked the address on the piece of stationery paper in my palm. I knocked. Then, a thing made of skin and bone, pretending to be Rahim Khan, opened the door. A creative writing teacher at San Jose State used to say this about clichés: avoid them like the plague. Then he would laugh at his own joke. The class laughed along with him, but I always thought clichés got a bum rap, because often they're dead on. But the aptness of the clichéd saying is overshadowed by the nature of the saying as a cliché. For example, the elephant in the room saying, nothing could more correctly describe the initial moments of my reunion with Rahim Khan. We sat on a wispy mattress set along the wall, across the window overlooking the noisy street below. Sunlight slanted in and cast a triangular wedge of light onto the Afghan rug on the floor. Two folding chairs rested against one wall, and a small copper samovar sat in the opposite corner. I poured us tea from it. How did you find me? I asked. It's not difficult to find people in America. I bought a map of the U.S. and called up information for cities in Northern California, he said. It's wonderfully strange to see you as a grown man. I smiled and dropped 3 sugar cubes in my tea. He liked his black and bitter, I remembered. No, Baba didn't get the chance to tell you, but I got married 15 years ago, I said. The truth was, by then, the cancer in Baba's brain had made him forgetful, negligent. You're married? To whom? Her name is Suraya Tahiri. I thought of her back home, worrying about me. I was glad she wasn't alone. Tahiri. Now, whose daughter is she? I told him. His eyes brightened. Oh, yes, I remember now. Isn't General Tahiri married to Sharif John's sister? What was her name? Jamila John, I offered. Bale, he said, smiling. I knew Sharif John in Kabul long time ago, before he moved to America. He's been working for the INS for years, I said. He handles a lot of Afghan cases. Hey, he sighed. Do you and Suraya John have children? No, I said. Oh. He slurped his tea and didn't ask more. Rahim Khan had always been one of the most instinctive people I had ever met. I told him a lot about Baba, his job, the flea market, and how, at the end, he had died happy. I told him about my schooling and my books, 4 published novels to my credit now. He smiled at this and said he had never had any doubt. I told him I had written short stories in the leather-bound notebook he had given me, but he didn't remember the notebook. The conversation, inevitably, turned to the Taliban. Is it as bad as I hear? I said. Nay, it's worse, much worse, he said. They don't let you be human. He pointed to a scar above his right eye, cutting a crooked path through his bushy eyebrow. I was at a soccer game in Ghazi Stadium in 1998, he said. Kabul against Mazar-e-Sharif, I think. And by the way, the players weren't allowed to wear shorts. Indecent exposure, I guess. He gave a tired laugh. Anyway, Kabul scored a goal, and the man next to me cheered loudly. Suddenly, this young bearded fellow who was patrolling the aisles, 18 years old at the most by the look of him, he walked up to me and struck me on the forehead with the butt of his Kalashnikov. Do that again, and I'll cut out your tongue, you old donkey, he said. Rahim Khan rubbed the scar with a gnarled finger. I was old enough to be his grandfather, and I was sitting there, blood gushing down my face, apologizing to that son of a dog. I poured him more tea. Rahim Khan talked some more. Much of it I knew already, some not. He told me that, as arranged between Baba and him, he had lived in Baba's house since 1981. This I knew about. Baba had sold the house to Rahim Khan shortly before he and I fled Kabul. The way Baba had seen it those days, Afghanistan's troubles were only a temporary interruption of our way of life. The days of parties at the Wazir Akbar Khan house and picnics in Paghman would surely return. So he had given the house to Rahim Khan to keep watch over until that day. Rahim Khan told me how, when the Northern Alliance took over Kabul between 1992 and 1996, different factions claimed different parts of Kabul. If you went from the Shahr-e-Now section to Karte Parwan to buy a carpet, you risk getting shot by a sniper or getting blown up by a rocket, he said, if you got past all the checkpoints, that was. You practically needed a visa to go from one neighborhood to the other. So people just stayed put and prayed the next rocket wouldn't hit their home. He told me how people knocked holes in the walls of their homes so they could bypass the dangerous streets and move down the block from hole to hole. In other parts, people moved about in underground tunnels. Why didn't you leave? I said. Kabul was my home. It still is, he said. He snickered. Remember the street that went from your house to the Qishla, the military barracks next to Istiqlal Middle School? Yes, I said. It was a shortcut to school. I remembered the day Hassan and I crossed it, and the soldiers had teased Hassan about his mother. Hassan had cried in the cinema later, and I had put an arm around him. Well, when the Taliban rolled in, Rahim Khan said, and kicked the alliance out of Kabul, I actually danced on that street. And believe me, I wasn't alone. People were celebrating at Chaman, at De Mazang, greeting the Taliban in the streets, climbing their tanks and posing for pictures with them. People were so tired of the constant fighting, tired of the rockets and the gunfire, the explosions, tired of watching Gulbuddin and his cohorts firing on anything that moved. The alliance did more damage to Kabul than the Shorawi. They destroyed your father's orphanage, did you know that? Why, I said, why would they destroy an orphanage? I remembered sitting behind Baba the day they opened the orphanage. The wind had knocked off his caracal hat and everyone had laughed, then stood and clapped when he had delivered his speech. And now, it was just another pile of rubble. All the money Baba had spent, all those nights he had sweated over the blueprints, all the visits to the construction site to make sure every brick, every beam, and every block was laid just right. Collateral damage, Rahim Khan said. You don't want to know, Amir John, what it was like sifting through the rubble of that orphanage. There were body parts of children. So when the Taliban came, I said, they were heroes, Rahim Khan said. Peace at last, I said. Yes, hope is a strange thing. Peace at last. But at what price? A violent coughing fit gripped Rahim Khan and rocked his gaunt body back and forth. When he spat into his handkerchief, it immediately stained red. I thought that was as good time as any to address the elephant sweating with us in the tiny room. How are you? I asked. I mean, really, how are you? Dying, actually, he said in a gurgling voice. Another round of coughing. More blood on the handkerchief. He wiped his mouth and blotted his sweaty brow from one wasted temple to the other with his sleeve and gave me a quick glance. When he nodded, I knew he had read the next question on my face. Not long, he breathed. How long? He shrugged and coughed again. I don't think I'll see the end of this summer, he said. Let me take you home with me. I can find you a good doctor. They're coming up with new treatments all the time. There are new drugs and experimental treatments. We could enroll you in one. I was rambling and I knew it, but it was better than crying, which I was probably going to do anyway. He let out a chuff of wheezy laughter and revealed missing lower incisors. It was the most tired laughter I had ever heard. I see America has infused you with the optimism that has made her so great, he said. That's very good. We're a melancholic people, we Afghans, aren't we? Often, we wallow too much in ramkhuri and self-pity. We give in to loss, to suffering, and accept it as a fact of life, even see it as necessary. Zindagi migzara, we say. Life goes on. But I'm not surrendering to fate here. I'm being pragmatic. I've seen several good doctors here, and they have given the same answer. I trust them and believe them. There is such a thing as God's will. There is only what you do and what you don't do, I said. Rahim Khan laughed. You sounded like your father just now. I miss him so much. But it is God's will, Amir John. It really is. He paused. Besides, there's another reason I asked you to come here. I wanted to see you before I go, yes. But something else, too. Anything, I said. You know all those years I lived in your father's house after you left? Yes. I wasn't alone for all of them. Hassan lived there with me. Hassan, I said. When was the last time I had spoken his name? Those thorny old barbs of guilt bore into me once more, as if speaking his name had broken a spell and set them free to torment me anew. Suddenly, the air in Rahim Khan's little flat was too thick, too hot, too rich with the smell of the street. I thought about writing you and telling you before, Rahim Khan said, but I wasn't sure you wanted to know. Was I wrong? The truth was no. The lie was yes. I settled for something in between. I don't know, I said. He coughed another patch of blood into the handkerchief. When he bent his head to spit, I saw honey-crusted sores on his scalp. I brought you here because I'm going to ask something of you, he said. I'm going to ask you to do something for me. But before I do, I want to tell you about Hassan. Do you understand? Yes, I murmured. I want to tell you about him, Rahim Khan said. I want to tell you everything. You will listen? I nodded. Then Rahim Khan sipped some more tea, rested his head against the wall, and spoke. Rahim Khan's story. There were a lot of reasons why I went to Hazarajat to find Hassan in 1986. The biggest one, Allah forgive me, was that I was lonely. By then, most of my friends and relatives had either been killed or had escaped the country to Pakistan or Iran. I barely knew anyone in Kabul anymore, the city where I had lived my entire life. Everybody had fled. I would take a walk in the Karte Parwan section, where the melon vendors used to hang out in the old days, you remember that spot? And I wouldn't recognize anyone there. No one to greet, no one to sit down with for chai, no one to share stories with, just Rusi soldiers patrolling the streets. So eventually, I stopped going to the city. I would spend my days in your father's house, up in the study, reading your mother's old books, listening to the news, or watching the communist propaganda on television. Then I would pray namaz, cook something, eat, read some more, pray again, and go to bed. I would rise in the morning, pray, and do it all over again. And with my arthritis, it was getting harder for me to maintain the house. My knees and back were always aching. I would get up in the morning, and it would take me at least an hour to shake the stiffness from my joints, especially in the wintertime. I did not want to let your father's house go to rot. We had all had so many good times in that house, so many memories, Amir John. It wasn't right. Your father had designed that house himself. It had meant so much to him. And besides, I had promised him I would care for it when he and you left for Pakistan. Now, it was just me in the house, and I did my best. I tried to water the trees every few days, cut the lawn, tend to the flowers, fix things that needed fixing, but even then, I was not a young man anymore. But even so, I might have been able to manage, at least for a while longer. But when news of your father's death reached me, for the first time, I felt a terrible loneliness in that house, a terrible emptiness. So one day, I fueled up the Buick and drove up to Hazarajat. I remembered that after Ali dismissed himself from the house, your father told me he and Hassan had moved to a small village just outside Bamiyan. Ali had a cousin there, as I recalled. I had no idea if Hassan would still be there, if anyone would even know of him or his whereabouts. After all, it had been 10 years since Ali and Hassan had left your father's house. Hassan would have been a grown man in 1986, 22, 23 years old maybe, if he was even alive, that is. The Shorawi, may they rot in hell for what they did to our Watan, killed so many of our young men. I don't have to tell you that. But, with the grace of God, I found him there. It took very little searching. All I had to do was ask a few questions in Bamiyan, and people pointed me to his village. I do not even recall its name, or whether it even had one. But I remember it was a scorching summer day, and I was driving up a rutted dirt road, nothing on either side but sun-baked bushes, gnarled spiny tree stems, and dried grass like pale straw. I passed a dead donkey rotting on the side of the road. And then I turned a corner, and right in the middle of that barren land, I saw a cluster of mud houses, beyond them nothing but broad sky and mountains like jagged teeth. The people in Bamiyan had told me I would find him easily. He lived in the only house in the village that had a walled garden. The mud wall, short and pocked with holes, enclosed the tiny house, which was really not much more than a glorified hut. Barefoot children were playing on the street, kicking a ragged tennis ball with a stick, and they stared when I pulled up and killed the engine. I knocked on the wooden door and stepped through into a yard that had very little in it, save for a parched strawberry patch and a bare lemon tree. There was a tandoor in the corner, in the shadow of an acacia tree, and I saw a man squatting beside it. He was placing dough on a large wooden spatula and slapping it against the walls of the tandoor. He dropped the dough when he saw me. I had to make him stop kissing my hands. "Let me look at you," I said. He stepped away. He was so tall now. I stood on my toes and still just came up to his chin. The Bamiyan sun had toughened his skin and turned it several shades darker than I remembered, and he had lost a few of his front teeth. There were spare strands of hair on his chin. Other than that, he had those same narrow green eyes, that scar on his upper lip, that round face, that affable smile. You would have recognized him, Amirjan. I'm sure of it. We went inside. There was a young, light-skinned Hazara woman sewing a shawl in a corner of the room. She was visibly expecting. "This is my wife, Rahim Khan," Hassan said proudly. "Her name is Farzana John." She was a shy woman, so courteous she spoke in a voice barely higher than a whisper, and she would not raise her pretty hazel eyes to meet my gaze. But the way she was looking at Hassan, he might as well have been sitting on the throne at the Ark. "When is the baby coming?" I said after we all settled around the adobe room. There was nothing in the room, just a frayed rug, a few dishes, a pair of mattresses, and a lantern. "Inshallah this winter," Hassan said. "I am praying for a boy to carry on my father's name." "Speaking of Ali, where is he?" I asked. Hassan dropped his gaze. He told me that Ali and his cousin, who had owned the house, had stepped on a landmine 2 years before, just outside of Bamiyan. Both had died instantly. A landmine. Is there a more Afghan way of dying, Amirjan? And for some crazy reason, I became absolutely certain that it had been Ali's right leg, his twisted polio leg, that had finally betrayed him and stepped on that landmine. I was deeply saddened to hear Ali had died. Your father and I grew up together, as you know, Amirjan, and Ali had been with him as long as I could remember. I remember when we were all little, the year Ali got polio and almost died, your father would walk around the house all day, crying. Farzana made us shorwa with beans, turnips, and potatoes. We washed our hands and dipped fresh naan from the tandoor into the shorwa. It was the best meal I had had in months. It was then that I asked Hassan to move to Kabul with me. I told him about the house and how I could not care for it by myself anymore. I told him I would pay him well, that he and his khanum would be comfortable. They looked to each other and did not say anything. Later, after we had washed our hands and Farzana had served us grapes, Hassan said the village was his home now. He and Farzana had made a life for themselves there. And Bamiyan is so close. We know people there. Forgive me, Rahim Khan. I pray you understand. Of course, I said. You have nothing to apologize for. I understand. It was midway through tea after shorwa that Hassan asked about you. I told him you were in America, but that I did not know much more. Hassan had so many questions about you. Had you married? Did you have children? How tall were you? Did you still fly kites and go to the cinema? Were you happy? He said he had befriended an old Farsi teacher in Bamiyan who had taught him to read and write. If he wrote you a letter, would I pass it on to you? And did I think you would write back? I told him what I knew of you from the few phone conversations I had had with your father, but mostly I did not know how to answer him. Then he asked me about your father. When I told him, Hassan buried his face in his hands and broke into tears. He wept like a child for the rest of that night. They insisted that I spend the night there. Farzana fixed a cot for me and left me a glass of well water in case I got thirsty. All night, I heard her whispering to Hassan and heard him sobbing. In the morning, Hassan told me he and Farzana had decided to move to Kabul with me. I should not have come here, I said. You were right, Hassan John. You have a zindagi, a life here. It was presumptuous of me to just show up and ask you to drop everything. It's me who needs to be forgiven. Well, we don't have that much to drop, Rahim Khan, Hassan said. His eyes were still red and puffy. We'll go with you. We'll help you take care of the house. Are you absolutely sure? I asked. He nodded and dropped his head. Agha Sahib was like my second father, God give him peace. They piled their things in the center of a few worn rags and tied the corners together. We loaded the bundle into the Buick. Hassan stood in the threshold of the house and held the Quran as we all kissed it and passed under it. Then we left for Kabul. I remember as I was pulling away, Hassan turned to take a last look at their home. When we got to Kabul, I discovered that Hassan had no intention of moving into the house. But all these rooms are empty, Hassan John. No one is going to live in them, I said. But he would not. He said it was a matter of ihtiram, a matter of respect. He and Farzana moved their things into the hut in the backyard where he was born. I pleaded for them to move into one of the guest bedrooms upstairs, but Hassan would hear nothing of it. What will Amir Agha think? He said to me. What will he think when he comes back to Kabul after the war and finds that I have assumed his place in the house? Then, in mourning for your father, Hassan wore black for the next 40 days. I did not want them to, but the two of them did all the cooking and all the cleaning. Hassan tended to the flowers in the garden, soaked the roots, picked off yellowing leaves, and planted rose bushes. He painted the walls. In the house, he swept rooms no one had slept in for years and cleaned bathrooms no one had bathed in, like he was preparing the house for someone's return. Do you remember the wall behind the row of corn your father had planted, Amir John? What did you and Hassan call it? The wall of ailing corn? A rocket destroyed a whole section of that wall in the middle of the night early that fall. Hassan rebuilt the wall with his own hands, brick by brick, until it stood whole again. I do not know what I would have done if he had not been there. Then late that fall, Farzana gave birth to a stillborn baby girl. Hassan kissed the baby's lifeless face, and we buried her in the backyard, near the sweetbriar bushes. We covered the little mound with leaves from the poplar trees. I said a prayer for her. Farzana stayed in the hut all day and wailed. It is a heartbreaking sound, Emirjan, the wailing of a mother. I pray to Allah you never hear it. Outside the walls of that house, there was a war raging. But the three of us, in your father's house, we made our own little haven from it. My vision started going by the late 1980s, so I had Hassan read me your mother's books. We would sit in the foyer by the stove, and Hassan would read me from Masnawi or Khayyam, as Farzana cooked in the kitchen. And every morning, Hassan placed a flower on the little mound by the sweetbriar bushes. In early 1990, Farzana became pregnant again. It was that same year, in the middle of the summer, that a woman covered in a sky blue burqa knocked on the front gates one morning. When I walked up to the gates, she was swaying on her feet like she was too weak to even stand. I asked her what she wanted, but she would not answer. "Who are you?" I said. But she just collapsed right there in the driveway. I yelled for Hassan, and he helped me carry her into the house, to the living room. We lay her on the sofa and took off her burqa. Beneath it, we found a toothless woman with stringy graying hair and sores on her arms. She looked like she had not eaten for days. But the worst of it by far was her face. Someone had taken a knife to it and, Amirjan, the slashes cut this way and that way. One of the cuts went from cheekbone to hairline, and it had not spared her left eye on the way. It was grotesque. I patted her brow with a wet cloth and she opened her eyes. "Where is Hassan?" she whispered. "I'm right here," Hassan said. He took her hand and squeezed it. Her good eye rolled to him. "I have walked long and far to see if you are as beautiful in the flesh as you are in my dreams. And you are, even more." She pulled his hand to her scarred face. "Smile for me, please." Hassan did, and the old woman wept. "You smiled coming out of me, did anyone ever tell you? And I wouldn't even hold you. Allah forgive me, I wouldn't even hold you." None of us had seen Sanaubar since she had eloped with a band of singers and dancers in 1964, just after she had given birth to Hassan. You never saw her, Amir, but in her youth, she was a vision. She had a dimpled smile and a walk that drove men crazy. No one who passed her on the street, be it a man or a woman, could look at her only once. And now, Hassan dropped her hand and bolted out of the house. I went after him, but he was too fast. I saw him running up the hill where you two used to play, his feet kicking up plumes of dust. I let him go. I sat with Sanaubar all day as the sky went from bright blue to purple. Hassan still had not come back when night fell and moonlight bathed the clouds. Sanaubar cried that coming back had been a mistake, maybe even a worse one than leaving. But I made her stay. Hassan would return, I knew. He came back the next morning looking tired and weary, like he had not slept all night. He took Sanaubar's hand in both of his and told her she could cry if she wanted to, but she needn't. She was home now, he said, home with her family. He touched the scars on her face and ran his hand through her hair. Hassan and Farzana nursed her back to health. They fed her and washed her clothes. I gave her one of the guest rooms upstairs. Sometimes I would look out the window into the yard and watch Hassan and his mother kneeling together, picking tomatoes or trimming a rose bush, talking. They were catching up on all those lost years, I suppose. As far as I know, he never asked her where she had been or why she had left, and she never told. I guess some stories do not need telling. It was Saint-Aubert who delivered Hassan's son that winter of 1990. It had not started snowing yet, but the winter winds were blowing through the yards, bending the flower beds and rustling the leaves. I remember Saint-Aubert came out of the hut holding her grandson. She had him wrapped in a wool blanket. She stood beaming under a dull gray sky, tears streaming down her cheeks, the needle-cold wind blowing her hair and clutching that baby in her arms like she never wanted to let go. Not this time. She handed him to Hassan, and he handed him to me, and I sang the prayer of Ayatul Kursi in that little boy's ear. They named him Sohrab, after Hassan's favorite hero from the Shahnameh, as you know, Amir John. He was a beautiful little boy, sweet as sugar, and had the same temperament as his father. You should have seen Saint-Aubert with that baby, Amir John. He became the center of her existence. She sewed clothes for him and built him toys from scraps of wood, rags, and dried grass. When he caught a fever, she stayed up all night and fasted for 3 days. She burnt Isfan for him on a skillet to cast out Nazar, the evil eye. By the time Sohrab was 2, he was calling her Sasa. The two of them were inseparable. She lived to see him turn 4, and then, one morning, she just didn't wake up. She looked calm, at peace, like she didn't mind dying now. We buried her in the cemetery on the hill, the one by the pomegranate tree, and I said a prayer for her too. The loss was hard on Hassan. It always hurts more to have and lose than to not have in the first place. But it was even harder on little Sohrab. He kept walking around the house, looking for Sasa. But you know how children are. They forget so quickly. By then, that would have been 1995, the Shorawi were defeated and long gone, and Kabul belonged to Masoud, Rabbani, and the Mujahideen. The infighting between the factions was fierce, and no one knew if they would live to see the end of the day. Our ears became accustomed to the whistles of falling shells, to the rumble of gunfire, our eyes familiar with the sight of men digging bodies out of piles of rubble. Kabul in those days, Amir John, was as close as you could get to that proverbial hell on earth. Allah was kind to us, though. The Wazir Akbar Khan area was not attacked as much, so we did not have it as bad as some of the other neighborhoods. On those days when the rocket fire eased up a bit and the gunfighting was light, Hassan would take Sohrab to the zoo to see Marjan the Lion or to the cinema. Hassan taught him how to shoot the slingshot, and later, by the time he was 8, Sohrab had become deadly with that thing. He could stand on the terrace and hit a pine cone propped on a pail halfway across the yard. Hassan taught him to read and write. His son was not going to grow up illiterate like he had. I grew very attached to that little boy. I had seen him take his first step and heard him utter his first word. I bought Iranian children's books for Sohrab from the bookstore by the cinema park. They have destroyed that too now, and Sohrab read them as quickly as I could get them to him. He reminded me of you, how you loved to read when you were little, Amir John. Sometimes I read to him at night and played riddles with him, taught him card tricks. I miss him terribly. In the wintertime, Hassan took his son kite running. There were not nearly as many kite tournaments as in the old days. No one felt safe outside for too long, but there were still a few scattered tournaments. Hassan would prop Sohrab on his shoulders, and they would go trotting through the streets, running kites, climbing trees where kites had dropped. You remember, Amir John, what a good kite runner Hassan was? He was still just as good. At the end of winter, Hassan and Sohrab would hang the kites they had run all winter on the walls of the main hallway. They would put them up like paintings. I told you how we all celebrated in 1996 when the Taliban rolled in and put an end to the daily fighting. I remember coming home that night and finding Hassan in the kitchen, listening to the radio. He had a sober look in his eyes. I asked him what was wrong, and he just shook his head. "God help the Hazaras now, Rahim Khan Sahib," he said. "The war is over, Hassan," I said. "There's going to be peace, inshallah, and happiness and calm. No more rockets, no more killing, no more funerals." But he just turned off the radio and asked if he could get me anything before he went to bed. A few weeks later, the Taliban banned kite fighting. And 2 years later, in 1998, they massacred the Hazaras in Mazar-e-Sharif. Rahim Khan slowly uncrossed his legs and leaned against the bare wall in the wary, deliberate way of a man whose every movement triggers spikes of pain. Outside, a donkey was braying and someone was shouting something in Urdu. The sun was beginning to set, glittering red through the cracks between the ramshackle buildings. It hit me again, the enormity of what I had done that winter and that following summer. The names rang in my head: Hassan, Sohrab, Ali, Farzana, and Sanobar. Hearing Rahim Khan speak Ali's name was like finding an old dusty music box that hadn't been opened in years. The melody began to play immediately. "Who did you eat today, Babalu? Who did you eat, you slant-eyed Babalu?" I tried to conjure Ali's frozen face, to really see his tranquil eyes. But time can be a greedy thing. Sometimes it steals all the details for itself. "Is Hassan still in that house now?" I asked. Rahim Khan raised the teacup to his parched lips and took a sip. He then fished an envelope from the breast pocket of his vest and handed it to me. "For you." I tore the sealed envelope. Inside, I found a Polaroid photograph and a folded letter. I stared at the photograph for a full minute. A tall man dressed in a white turban and a green striped chapan stood with a little boy in front of a set of wrought iron gates. Sunlight slanted in from the left, casting a shadow on half of his rotund face. He was squinting and smiling at the camera, showing a pair of missing front teeth. Even in this blurry Polaroid, the man in the chapan exuded a sense of self-assuredness, of ease. It was in the way he stood, his feet slightly apart, his arms comfortably crossed on his chest, his head tilted a little toward the sun. Mostly, it was in the way he smiled. Looking at the photo, one might have concluded that this was a man who thought the world had been good to him. Rahim Khan was right. I would have recognized him if I had bumped into him on the street. The little boy stood barefoot, one arm wrapped around the man's thigh, his shaved head resting against his father's hip. He too was grinning and squinting. I unfolded the letter. It was written in Farsi. No dots were omitted, no crosses forgotten, no letters blurred together. The handwriting was almost childlike in its neatness. I began to read. "In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Amir Agha, with my deepest respects. Farzana John, Sohrab and I pray that this latest letter finds you in good health and in the light of Allah's good graces. Please offer my warmest thanks to Rahim Khan Sahib for carrying it to you. I am hopeful that one day I will hold one of your letters in my hands and read of your life in America. Perhaps a photograph of you will even grace our eyes. I have told much about you to Farzana John and Sohrab, about us growing up together and playing games and running in the streets. They laugh at all the stories of all the mischief you and I used to cause. Amir Agha, alas, the Afghanistan of our youth is long dead. Kindness is gone from the land, and you cannot escape the killings. Always the killings. In Kabul, Fear is everywhere, in the streets, in the stadium, in the markets. It is a part of our lives here, Amiraga. The savages who rule our watan don't care about human decency. The other day, I accompanied Farzana Jan to the bazaar to buy some potatoes and naan. She asked the vendor how much the potatoes cost, but he did not hear her. I think he had a deaf ear. So she asked louder, and suddenly a young Taleb ran over and hit her on the thighs with his wooden stick. He struck her so hard she fell down. He was screaming at her and cursing and saying, "The ministry of vice and virtue does not allow women to speak loudly." She had a large purple bruise on her leg for days. But what could I do except stand and watch my wife get beaten? If I fought, that dog would have surely put a bullet in me and gladly. Then what would happen to my Sohrab? The streets are full enough already of hungry orphans, and every day I thank Allah that I am alive. Not because I fear death, but because my wife has a husband and my son is not an orphan. I wish you could see Sohrab. He is a good boy. Rahim Khan Sahib and I have taught him to read and write so he does not grow up stupid like his father. And can he shoot with that slingshot? I take Sohrab around Kabul sometimes and buy him candy. There is still a monkey man in Shahr-e-Now, and if we run into him, I pay him to make his monkey dance for Sohrab. You should see how he laughs. The two of us often walk up to the cemetery on the hill. Do you remember how we used to sit under the pomegranate tree there and read from the Shahnama? The droughts have dried the hill, and the tree hasn't borne fruit in years. But Sohrab and I still sit under its shade, and I read to him from the Shahnama. It is not necessary to tell you that his favorite part is the one with his namesake, Rustam and Sohrab. Soon, he will be able to read from the book himself. I am a very proud and very lucky father. Amir Agha, Rahim Khan Sahib is quite ill. He coughs all day, and I see blood on his sleeve when he wipes his mouth. He has lost much weight, and I wish he would eat a little of the shorwa and rice that Farzana Jan cooks for him. But he only takes a bite or two, and even that, I think, is out of courtesy to Farzana Jan. I am so worried about this dear man. I pray for him every day. He is leaving for Pakistan in a few days to consult some doctors there, and inshallah he will return with good news. But in my heart, I fear for him. Farzana Jan and I have told little Sohrab that Rahim Khan is going to be well. What can we do? He is only 10 and he adores Rahim Khan Sahib. They have grown so close to each other. Rahim Khan Sahib used to take him to the bazaar for balloons and biscuits, but he is too weak for that now. I have been dreaming a lot lately, Amir Agha. Some of them are nightmares, like hanged corpses rotting in soccer fields with blood-red grass. I wake up from those short of breath and sweaty. Mostly, though, I dream of good things and praise Allah for that. I dream that Rahim Khan Sahib will be well. I dream that my son will grow up to be a good person, a free person, and an important person. I dream that lala flowers would bloom in the streets of Kabul again, and rubab music will play in the samovar houses, and kites would fly in the skies. And I dream that someday you will return to Kabul to revisit the land of our childhood. If you do, you will find an old faithful friend waiting for you. May Allah be with you always. Hassan. I read the letter twice. I folded the note and looked at the photograph for another minute. I pocketed both. How is he? I asked. That letter was written 6 months ago, a few days before I left for Peshawar, Rahim Khan said. I took the Polaroid the day before I left. A month after I arrived in Peshawar, I received a telephone call from one of my neighbors in Kabul. He told me this story. Soon after I took my leave, a rumor spread that a Hazara family was living alone in the big house in Wazir Akbar Khan, or so the Taliban claim. A pair of Talib officials came to investigate and interrogated Hassan. They accused him of lying when Hassan told them he was living with me, even though many of the neighbors, including the one who called me, supported Hassan's story. The Talibs said he was a liar and a thief, like all Hazaras, and ordered him to get his family out of the house by sundown. Hassan protested,